Welcome everybody back to Thursday, it is? Yes, Thursday. Hey, and it's also the Damage Report. I'm also John. I'm fairly confident about those last two facts. We've got a big show for you that I'm also confident about. We've got three different guests who are gonna be joining us. So in just a little bit, Parker Malloy of Media Matters is gonna be back on the show. Always good to talk to Parker. Earlier this week, I actually got to speak with Tom Hartman, noted author, written over 20 books, longtime progressive host. We talked about the death of republics, Rome, and maybe America. So that'll be a fun chat. We'll have that for you a little bit later. And we're getting into that time of the year. We're gonna be starting talking about some big primary progressive challengers to establishment Democrats. We're gearing up for the election season, and we've got an awesome candidate we're gonna be talking to just a little bit later on. Also, Fox News all in on Donald Trump defending him against the new information revealed by Robert Mueller. We're gonna analyze two different ways that Fox has attempted to cover for Donald Trump, and the various ways that you would have to be a raving lunatic to buy what they are selling. And so that'll be the close of the show. So stay tuned for that. But we're gonna be starting off with John McCain and Donald Trump, and a little bit of fun for you. So John McCain passed away last year, but despite the fact that he is no longer alive, that has not stopped him from triggering Donald Trump on a daily basis. Not even just by his existence, but even by his non-existence. And so this story is going to be embarrassing, but it's going to be embarrassing for Donald Trump, so let's have some fun. We find out now that in his trip overseas, great lengths were gone to protect Donald Trump from even seeing the name of the former senator. The White House wanted the US Navy to move, quote, out of sight the warship USS John S. McCain ahead of President Trump's visit to Japan, according to an email reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. The ship was named originally after the father and grandfather of the late senator, and the senator's name was added to the ship in 2018. So this ship, has been around and everything, and it commemorates multiple generations because we are a weirdly dynastic country. But John McCain is one of them. He was a senator for a long time. I'm not a big fan of him, but he's a senator. The ship's named after him. And so look at the lengths that they went to make sure that Donald Trump, petulant child that he is, would not even have to see the name of John McCain. A tarp was hung over the ship's name ahead of the president's trip, according to photos reviewed by the journal, and sailors were directed to remove any coverings from the ship that bore its name. A barge was moved closer to the ship, obscuring its name. Sailors on the ship, who typically wear caps bearing its name, were given the day off during Mr. Trump's visit, people familiar with the matter said. So, every length was gone to. If his name is physically imprinted on the ship, we're going to cover it up with temporary coverings. We're gonna block as much of the ship as we can by moving other ships in the way of it. And even though the entire point is for Donald Trump to come and address these soldiers, and we'll get to that in just a second, those who would be wearing caps that would also have John McCain's name, we're gonna give them the day off. They're not actually going to be on duty, just so that Donald Trump doesn't have to gaze out into a crowd and see on a person who at that distance is gonna be small, an even smaller hat, and even smaller letters with John McCain spelled out. Because God only knows what would happen if that was the case. He could start a war or something. Now, let's show you a little image. You're gonna see one of the tarps covering up the name there. You see down by the bottom, it's a gray tarp. It would have just been another one of many words visible at somewhat great distance while he was giving this address. But let's talk a little bit about the evidence that we have of this. In a May 15th email to US Navy and Air Force officials, a US Indo-Pacific Command official outlined plans for the president's arrival that he said it had resulted from conversations between the White House military office and the 7th Fleet of the US Navy. In addition to instructions for the proper landing areas for helicopters and preparation for the USS Wasp, where the president was scheduled to speak, the official issued a third directive, quote, USS John McCain needs to be out of sight. They go on to this, and this is a lot of fun. When a Navy commander expressed surprise about the directive for the USS John S. McCain, the US Indo-Pacific Command official replied, first I heard of it as well. And thus then the directives went out, the orders went out, and that entire area was changed up, and stuff was covered, and stuff was moved around. And like at this point, you could at least try to come up with some sort of excuse why the US military needs to go to these great lengths to protect you. Now, I'm not saying directly that Donald Trump was involved with this. It doesn't seem that that's the truth. But when asked about this, look at how he talks about John McCain, even now, months and months and months after the guy has passed away, and what sort of situation he has created where someone would feel the need to protect him and insulate him from even the name of his former enemy.
I was very angry with John McCain because he killed health care. I was not a big fan of John McCain in any way, shape, or form. I think John McCain had a lot to getting President Bush, a lot to do with it, to go into the Middle East, which was a catastrophe. To me, John McCain, I wasn't a fan, but I would never do a thing like that. Now, somebody did it because they thought I didn't like him, okay? And they were well-meaning, I will say.
They were well-meaning. Look, at he even acknowledges that. So he's asked the question, were you involved in obscuring the name of a former senator? Which, look, if you had had anything to do with that, you would be just, how embarrassed would you be by that? And so you'd want to be very careful, right? You'd want to make clear that, no, that's ridiculous. I don't have anything against John McCain. But that's not the direction he went in. Asked about whether that this was done on his behalf, he instead launches into a bizarre rant against a guy who is dead. Says that he killed healthcare by not allowing them to kill the ACA, which is some weird mental gymnastics there. Yes, he was involved in the push for hostilities in the Middle East. Donald Trump is right there. That's one of the worst things that John McCain was involved in his life. But it's a little bit easier to make that case that you are differentiated from this warmonger John McCain if you're not currently pushing for wars in Venezuela and Iran right now. So it sort of undercuts your argument a little bit there. But then to the well-meaning, John, like, you can't bring up John McCain without Donald Trump losing his mind. And that is how you get to the point where people in the White House military office feel like they need to go to these extraordinary lengths to protect him. And it's actually a little bit of, I would say, atypical self-awareness of Donald Trump to say that they're well-meaning. Because on some level, even though the entire thing, this whole bizarre mission, is just designed to protect Donald Trump from even having to say the name of someone who just sets him off in this way, he sort of gets that he needs to be protected, that he needs to be insulated from these sorts of things, and perhaps understands that that's one of the main roles that the people who hang around him, whether in the Trump organization or in the White House, are designed to do, to protect him from his worst excesses and impulses in this bizarre way. But the thing about this is, while it's incredibly embarrassing that they had to do all of this to stop Donald Trump from losing his mind, even though he ended up losing his mind, that is, of course, nothing compared to what was revealed yesterday by Robert Mueller, far more consequential for the president. And so we're going to turn to Robert Mueller and Donald Trump now. Donald Trump has had a little bit of time now to absorb what happened yesterday in the press conference of Robert Mueller. And let's see how he's doing a day out. He went on a tweet storm. I'm not going to read you all of them. There are far too many. But he did say this, and this one stands out. Russia, Russia, Russia. That's all you heard at the beginning of this witch hunt hoax. And now Russia has disappeared because I had nothing to do with Russia helping me to get elected. It was a crime that didn't exist. So hold on. Let's just pause. Because he just said, because I had nothing to do with Russia helping me to get elected, which when I first read that, I thought, zoinks, that sure stands out. And I honestly thought about tweeting how long until he backtracks on this. But I'm pretty sure that I woke up a little bit late. I think he had already backtracked at that point, because despite the fact that he acknowledges there, perhaps not even understanding, perhaps it's just a subconscious thing, that yes, of course, Russia, to the extent that they had an influence, and I'm not saying that it had a big influence or had a measurable influence or that that's been proven, but if they had an influence, if they had a goal, it was clearly to help Donald Trump get elected. That is clear from what they have done. It was also clear in the Robert Mueller report. They said in the report that the Trump administration, at that point, the Trump campaign, knew that it would help them, or that the goal was that it would help them. And obviously, they had no interest in stymieing it. From the beginning until now, they deny that it even happened. They deny that it was done on their behalf or to benefit them, except in this one tweet. And that is, a huge issue all of its own. But there, Donald Trump is appearing to acknowledge for the first time what the vast majority of the country has long ago known. Only a few holdouts refused to accept that Russia was involved and that they did want Donald Trump to get elected. But he acknowledged it. And then like an hour later, he of course backtracked, as you'll see in this video.
No, Russia did not help me get elected. You know who got me elected? You know who got me elected? I got me elected. Russia didn't help me at all. Russia, if anything, I think helped the other side.
I mean, look, most of what you hear politically like when you wake up to when you go to sleep, most of what you hear in politics is absolute BS. But it is amazing the consistency and the vigor with which they will, even with this minor little stepping out of line with acknowledging it on the tweet, that they will cling to that idea that somehow Russia was actually hoping that Hillary Clinton would win, and that their efforts to release damning information about Hillary Clinton was designed to get her into office. Donald Trump is clinging to that, even though he clearly does not actually believe that. No one actually believes that. I just want to mention one other thing, just because this is a weird thing that I forget exactly who it was on Twitter. They acknowledged this. Donald Trump has this thing. It's some sort of weird, like, baboon power move that he does, where whenever he's against a person, he has to say, almost always in tweet form, that that person asked him for something and he gleefully denied them that thing, that he rejected this person. If you look through his Twitter activity, everyone he has feuded with, he says wanted something and he denied them. And so Robert Mueller, this is the first time I've ever seen this. We're like 2 years into this thing, and only after Robert Mueller finally speaks does he come out with this. Robert Mueller came to the Oval Office along with other potential candidates seeking to be named the director of the FBI. He had already been in that position for 12 years. I told him no. The next day he was named special counsel. A total conflict of interest. Nice. So look, he's saying that today. Steve Bannon already is quoted in the Mueller report as saying that the idea that Robert Mueller had been attempting to work for Donald Trump was not true. It's odd that he's going back to that after it's already been refuted. But I just love that weird tick, this weird sort of kid-like version of being an alpha male, this ridiculous, shallow version of masculinity where I had something over this person. They wanted something from me and I denied them. Okay, he pointed out like 11 different ways that you obstructed justice, and this is you getting power back over him? I don't know. It's pathetic, but of course, that's run of the mill in American politics in these days. We're gonna take a short break. When we come back, we're gonna be joined by a couple of awesome guests after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us once again on the show, editor-at-large for Media Matters for America, Parker Malloy. Welcome back to the Narrative Report.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I noticed something that you were talking about on Twitter that I really wanted to talk to you about, and it had to do with your research into the way that right-wing media talks about the transgender community. One particular topic that they focus on quite a bit in a very specific way, and it has to do with athletics. Can you talk a little bit about what you found in your analysis?
Sure. Well, as a transgender person myself, I am obviously very interested in these issues. So one thing that constantly keeps gets brought up, even when it's not necessarily relevant, is the inclusion of transgender people in sports. And so I was on Twitter the other day, and I saw someone respond to news that the Trump administration's Department of Health and Human Services was rolling out a new rule that will honestly be pretty devastating to transgender people in general. So in response to that, I saw someone post a photo of a transgender athlete ready to run a track meet, I think. And that kind of set me off on this little bit of a tangent where I started talking about, how that is essentially, it's used as a way to strike fear into the minds of people who might ordinarily be pro-trans generally. They try to divert this issue of basic human rights to, yes, but what if they try to make the movie Ladybugs, where you have a guy dressed up as a girl so they can win a soccer tournament. What if someone tries to make that reality? Mm-hmm. And
it's a great movie, by the way.
I love that movie. It's Rodney Dangerfield. Yeah, it's a great movie. So I started kind of going off on that a little bit and talking about that. And one thing that happens is, first off, that issue, as I was saying, is kind of a red herring in itself. But what also happens is you see this unnecessary focus on trans athletes when they win. You never hear stories about a trans woman who was a runner got crushed at the finals or something like that. You only hear these stories where it's framed in this sort of question of whether or not there's an unfair advantage, as though there's no chance for the other athletes if a trans woman is allowed to compete. And, it ignores the science behind a lot of things. It ignores the fact that something that might be an advantage in one sport is a disadvantage in another. Mm-hmm. Being tall might be good in volleyball, but maybe not for something that's not volleyball.
I literally only know about volleyball, so yeah, I can't help you. Yeah,
it's volleyball and basketball.
Yeah.
And both are both height kind of helps. But in that case, they kind of ignore that, but they also ignore when they lose, and that creates what's basically called an availability heuristic. It's why when you think about plane crashes are extremely rare, but it's still a thing people worry about. Should they worry about it? Probably not. But when a plane lands, we hear a story about it. When a plane crashes, we hear a story about it. When a plane lands safely, no one runs a news story about this. And it's the same kind of thing that happens with trans athletes. We hear about trans athletes who win, or we hear about controversy leading up to participation, but we don't hear about when they lose. And that kind of creates this impression that you've got these trans women running around and just dominating sports left and right. But the truth is that there's never been a trans athlete that's really dominated any professional or Olympic level or NCAA sport. There are no trans LeBron Jameses or Bryce Harpers or any other famous sort of athlete. And it's something that's been brought up for 40 plus years. When Rene Richards competed in the US Open back in the 70s as a trans woman, some of the arguments against her inclusion were that what this will do is this will create an incentive for men who want to win sports to come out as trans just to do that. And that's obviously not happened. And it's a way to distract from these larger sort of issues about employment discrimination and housing and healthcare. And I think that's why it's disingenuous. You don't see the Daily Caller writing about women's sports unless it's to dunk on a trans woman who wanted to compete on her high school, baseball team or something like that.
Yeah.
You don't see, the Daily Wire writing about, the Division II NCAA finals for a track meet, which was a recent thing that both outlets recently wrote on, where they're talking about how unfair it was. And then the trans athlete who ran, was a woman named Cece. She came in sixth. So they didn't write about it again.
Yeah.
And then she, I guess over the weekend, just won another meet. She won a meet and now people are talking about her again. And that kind of proves the point where people weren't interested in talking about her when she lost, but when she wins, they are all about, shining a light on this. It's exactly. Because it props up their, it really props up their narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. And the most disingenuous thing about it, of course, is that you take something that, the decision to transition, you know, especially as stigmatized as it remains in our society, which is obviously an incredibly core fundamental thing to a person. And you frame it in a way that it's a thing that people do to get an advantage in college athletics. Like, you take something that's so core and fundamental and you pitch it as a thing that is totally superfluous and shallow. Which is disappointing as well. And so, because of how important this is, you know, I very much appreciated your analysis and your continued focus on the topic. Parker, it's always great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, Tom Hartman joined the show to talk about the death of republics. We'll break that down after this. Earlier this week, I was lucky enough to talk with author and host Tom Hartman about how republics die. Take a look.
In the age of Donald Trump, it's pretty clear that on a daily basis, damage is being done to the republic. But how much of that damage can actually be laid specifically at the doorstep of Donald Trump? And were we to move past Donald Trump, how much would that do to actually solve the problems we're faced with? Joining us now to break it down is author and talk show host Tom Hartman. Tom, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, John. Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Very glad to have you on. I've enjoyed your work for quite a while, and it's an honor to have you on the program. I read your article recently, This Is How Republics Die, where you talk about the fall of Rome and what you're witnessing every day in America. And in that article, you say that the death of a republic is different from the death of a nation. What do you mean by that?
Well, I was basing that on Rome, although I think you can see that same thing being played out in country after country, you know, in the last, even just the last 100 years of history. You know, Italy post Mussolini was a very different country than pre Mussolini, but it was still Italy. Germany with Hitler, Spain with Franco, you know, list goes on. Today, the Philippines with the guy who's running the Philippines. Yeah, Duterte. Thank you very much. And, you know, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. I mean, we've got country after country, Erdogan in Egypt, El Sisi in Egypt, Erdogan in Turkey. We got country after country that once was a republic that now has become basically an authoritarian strongman state. Now, in the case of Rome started about, you know, Rome was arguably a republic for about 300 years, solidly a republic, and existed for about 500 years before the death of Julius Caesar, which was around the time that it ceased to be a republic and began to be basically a quasi-authoritarian state and an empire at the same time, although it grew to be an empire while it was a republic. And then, you know, once the republican form, small r republican form of government died as a result of, well, some of the things I talk about in the article, the rise of factionalism and the rise of great power at the individual and kind of corporate level, it never recovered. And I mean, Rome, the Empire of Rome still exists today. It's called the Roman Catholic Church. The formal nation state of Rome ceased to exist, I think it was 1435 or 1534, you know, when Constantinople was sacked. But so, you know, Rome was around for 2,000 years. Only 300 years of that was as a republic.
And so, look, I think in the modern day, pretty much everything has been normalized. And there might be some people who hear comparisons between where we are today and the fall of Rome and say, well, surely it's not that bad. So what do you see when you look out at America over the past few years? What are you seeing as symptoms that you think might herald the death of our republic?
Well, widespread authoritarianism, first of all. The Trump presidency is based on authoritarianism, or he's certainly moving us in that direction. The idea that the core sense of what we are as a republic, instead of revolving around a constitutional form of government or a set of ideals or even a set of laws, is instead revolving around the personality of its leader. That's one of the main ways that republics die. The other thing is that, and this is what killed Rome as well in part, is the rise of special interest groups in the United States today. It would be the petrobillionaires or the billionaire class generally, but in particular the petrobillionaires. In Rome, it was other groups. It was primarily military groups. But the rise of special interest groups that have or acquire so much wealth that they can translate into political power that the individual politicians become afraid of them and unwilling to challenge them. And then the consequence of that, of course, is that the politicians start ignoring the people and not passing what the people want. And the consequence of that is that the people stop feeling like any sense of, you know, appropriate involvement with their government, or they get cynical, or they start looking for a strongman who's going to come in and fix things. And we're certainly seeing that now. I mean, you know well the study that came out of, I think it was Princeton a few years ago, the Gillens and Page study that found that the political desires of the top 10% of Americans economically are regularly enacted into law. The political desires of the bottom 90% of Americans, the probability of their being turned into a law in any given year is equivalent to random noise.
Yeah.
That's the sign of a dying republic.
And that is by itself very scary. Your article, which is available on Common Dreams, I believe, lays out some of the Supreme Court decisions that have moved us to this point where these petrobillionaires and billionaires of other sorts are able to translate their economic power into political power. You were talking about sort of cults of personality coming to dominate politics, and we clearly have some of those, including around Donald Trump. So we have this conversation that's going on around whether Donald Trump is a symptom or a consequence, where in the chain of causality he lies. And so in your mind, let's say that in 2020, Donald Trump is defeated. How far does that go to getting us to where we need to be?
I think that our republic has been extraordinarily badly damaged. The damage goes back a long ways. Some of the high points of that damage are 1976, the Buckley decision, Buckley versus Vallejo, just prior to that, of course, the release of the Powell memo, at least release into the right-wing wealth ecosphere, essentially. 2010, Citizens United. These were all decisions and laws in between that handed more and more power off to this wealthy, wealthy class that was then able to intimidate politicians. So now you've got now we're at a point where they being the petrobillionaires, have so much money and they're using it so aggressively to influence politics that, to the best of my knowledge, there's not a single federally elected Republican who's willing to even acknowledge climate change, which is insane when you think about it, because I mean, you know, the science is absolutely irrefutable and you can see it all around you right now. Look at the tornadoes and the wild storms and things. So, you know, that kind of damage is what sets a country up for the phenomena of a strongman like Donald Trump. So it was really a perfect storm. We had, our republic had been badly weakened by these horrible Supreme Court decisions. A group of billionaires at the urging of Lewis Powell stepped in and created a massive white right-wing infrastructure from think tanks to the colleges, you know, taking over college econ and political science classes, and now science as well, absolute outright funding of politicians. And then as a consequence of that, the politics becomes more and more polarized. And we look at this and go, oh, geez, our politics is so polarized. That's terrible. We need to be depolarized. Well, the reason why this big gap has occurred, the reason why we're so polarized, is because there is so much money on one side demanding that these politicians act exactly as they say and not one word different. And that is what kills republics. So even if Donald Trump went away this afternoon and took Mike Pence with him, and Speaker Pelosi became president, we would still have the problem from now until this problem is resolved of great wealth having the ability to manipulate the politics of this country and thus damage our ability to be a small d democratic, small r republic.
And so I suppose if we see this threat, and in your article you lay out some of the bases of power for Donald Trump, you're both historically leading to Trump, but then also who is keeping them in power today. I guess the defenders hypothetically would be the Democratic Party, although of course many of them receive money from these same sorts of interests that you're talking about. And so how much faith do you have in the Democratic Party to stand against this? And if not, what needs to happen to the Democrats to get them to where they need to be to make sure that our republic does not die?
Well, I think for any of us to put all our faith and hope in a political party is a huge mistake. The Democratic Party is, part of large parts of the Democratic Party are badly contaminated by corporate and billionaire money. On the other hand, you've got a number of candidates for office from literally dog catcher and school board all the way up to president of the United States who are refusing to take that kind of money and, taking principal positions on this. That's a good thing, and it's not happening at all in the Republican Party anywhere at any level. So in that context, if we're going to get ourselves out of this, it's probably going to be through the vehicle of the Democratic Party. It's not the party that's going to do it. It's the people in the party. And that's where, we just all need to get politically active. We democracy is not a spectator sport. We have to be involved. And we have to get as many of our friends and people of goodwill involved as possible, because the only way that you can defeat organized money, as Franklin Roosevelt said in 1936, is with organized people.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom Hartman, I appreciate you joining us on the show today. You're the host of the Tom Hartman Program, author of more than 20 books, and I appreciate your content generally, but then especially in this topic. I think it's been much needed at this point.
Thanks a lot. And the article, I think, just went up on Salon also, and I really appreciate you having me on your show, John. Thank you.
Thank you. Anytime. We're going to take a short break. We come back, more to get to.
The last midterm cycle was an amazing one for getting rid of people who've been involved in politics for a long time and are not actually working for the good of the Democratic Party or America in general. But that work continues going to this next election. And we're going to be profiling a number of awesome candidates over the course of the next few months. And one joins us now, Yasmin Taib. Welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Excited to have you here. So you're running in Virginia's 35th Senate district, and you're running against someone who's been in politics since basically America was a country. So can you tell us about the race that you're running in, the person that you're running against?
Absolutely. So this is the first time that the current incumbent has faced a challenger since 1979. That's before I was even born. Mm-hmm. The reason why this race is so incredibly important is our district is the most progressive Democratic district in the entire state of Virginia. And yet it's been represented by one of the most conservative Democrats we have in the General Assembly. And he's our minority leader for the last 40 years. He's stalled progress in terms of, fighting for campaign finance reform, making sure that Virginia transitions to a clean energy economy, making sure that we increase wages for our workers, key issues that we're fighting for in this campaign.
And so I want to talk about your platform and your background, but I also want people to understand what you're going up against. So as you pointed out, Dick Saslaw, who currently holds the spot, has been there for a very long time, but he's also incredibly closely tied with one of the big political donors in the state. Can you tell us about that relationship?
Absolutely. He is the top recipient of money from Dominion Energy. Dominion is one of the most influential, corporations right now in Richmond. They make contribute millions of dollars to legislators, literally ripping off our consumers and buying off our legislators. And taking money from a state-regulated monopoly is a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. So what we're fighting for in this campaign is ensuring that we do everything we possibly can to be successful on June 11th so we can get Dominion's influence out of Richmond. There's been legislation that's already been introduced in the General Assembly that would prohibit public service utilities like Dominion from making any contributions to our legislators.
I'm also curious about the reception that your primary challenge to him has received. So you're going up against Senate Minority Leader. You are a Democratic National Committee woman. How have people responded to you choosing to challenge him?
Voters are so incredibly, thankful and supportive of our race. We launched our campaign last September. We've knocked on over 37,000 doors so far with, about 12 days to go to the June 11th primary. I can tell you that voters, progressive activists, our supporters from all across the district, the Commonwealth, the country, and, we have over 1,200 grassroots donors and donations to this campaign, which really is unprecedented for a state legislative race. So the support that we've been getting from our voters is what matters to us. And naturally, because of who I'm going up against, whatever you want to call them, the establishment, the you know, Democratic Party of Virginia leaders in the party, yes, absolutely, they were not happy about us getting in this race. I had several legislators last year before I announced my candidacy. They did everything they possibly could to ensure that we were not going to be challenging Dick Saslaw. I had on multiple occasions state senators calling me, threatening me, telling me my political future in Virginia would be over if I challenged him, that they would strip me of my DNC seat. And mind you, this is a seat I was elected to by Virginia Democrats. They have no right to do that. But again, we're just focusing on our voters, and our voters are incredibly thrilled to finally have the choice to vote for a progressive.
So you pointed out that this is the most progressive district in the state. So when you're knocking on those 37,000 doors and you're talking with these voters, what are the issues that you're focusing on to differentiate you from the incumbent?
Absolutely. One of the key issues that we've been focusing on during our campaign has been campaign finance reform. And because that issue touches on so many other issues that our voters care about. So when we're talking about ensuring that we get corporate special interests out of our politics, when we're talking about electing Democrats that are serious about fighting climate change and making sure that Virginia transitions away from fossil fuels to clean renewable energy, that we reject money from the fossil fuel industry. You know, when we're talking about ensuring that we support our working families, supporting our unions, this is the first time in a very long time that we have the opportunity to pick up Democratic majority, that's both chambers, and top on that agenda, on that list for our working families and our unions is repealing Virginia's anti-union right to work law. Yeah. So these are all the issues that we talk about, all the issues that our voters care about.
So I was recently going through some of your social media activity, and on your Twitter account, you have a video where you talk about the story of your family coming to America. So you immigrated to the US as a child. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and what effect that might have on you as you've been, you know, working and now running for office in the US?
Absolutely. So I came to the country when I was in the second grade. My family and I, we were refugees from Iran. We came during the Iran-Iraq War. And the experience that we had coming to the US was very similar to the experience of countless families right now, asylum seekers, refugees at the southern border that are, you know, being kicked, being shunned, being turned away at our border. Literally, they are going through the same experience that my family went through. We were fleeing violence and persecution. So for me, the reason why that background and that experience is so incredibly important for our race is also because of our district. Our district is one of the most diverse in the entire state of Virginia. Over 60% are non-white, over 40%, including myself, are foreign born. In Fairfax County, when we're talking about our residents, more than 1% of residents in Fairfax County currently are in deportation proceedings. These are issues that, you know, impact our neighbors. These are issues that our voters who aren't immigrants themselves, that they care about. They care about what's happening to their neighbors. They want someone in the General Assembly that's going to be fighting for them, for their neighbors every single day in office. Mm-hmm. Someone who is going to be pushing back against this administration's discriminatory and unconscionable policies. And that's what we need in our state Senate district. And those are the issues that I'm fighting for.
Well, Yasmin Taib, primary candidate in Virginia's 35th Senate District. It's a very exciting challenge, and hopefully we can check in a little bit later on during your run.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break. We come back a little bit from last night's and this morning's defense on Fox News of Donald Trump from what was revealed in Robert Mueller's press conference. We'll break that down after this. Let's talk a little bit about the ways that Fox News is attempting to defend Donald Trump from what was revealed, both in the Mueller report and in yesterday's comments by Robert Mueller himself. It comes in two different forms, but both are incredibly dishonest. The first, Fox and Friends, here is a short segment of this morning's broadcast.
He refuses to look at the nuance and the new language that Mueller put out. I don't blame him. He says, listen, he didn't find anything. That's it.
He said that means innocence. In this country, you have to be proven guilty. If there's not enough evidence to prove you guilty, you are still innocent. And he said, because they didn't do that, I am still innocent.
So, I kind of want to jettison a little bit of the fact that this is a talk show host and all that. Let's just be honest about what is going on there. They know that it's incredibly likely that Donald Trump is watching them. Like Pete Hegseth, you can see sometimes when he finishes a comment, he like looks at the camera almost as if he's staring into Donald Trump's eyes and wondering, did I do a good job? Did you like that little comment there? But look at what was in that clip. So in the Mueller report, you have basically three things. You have the facts about what Russia did, which are not up for dispute at this point. You have whether there was a criminal conspiracy between Russia and the Donald Trump campaign. And then you have obstruction of justice. And so they say, well, of course he's frustrated. He believes that he's innocent. And then Ainsley Earhart says, in this country, you're innocent until proven guilty, which is true. So they're saying, let's not talk about what Russia did. Let's not talk about corruption of justice. Let's just focus on the fact that Mueller specifically says there is insufficient evidence to charge a broader criminal conspiracy, which is true. And we have to accept that that is true. And that if someone was going to find the evidence, he had a lot of time, a lot of resources, a lot of people. Now, he did face fairly unprecedented obstruction of justice, but he had a lot of access too. So it is true. They had insufficient evidence. But as a human, don't you hear that and think, okay, we're not going to charge him. It doesn't look like he did anything, but that's not as reassuring as you're pretending it is. Like, imagine if you found out that I was being investigated for killing my brother. And after 2 years, they come back and say, there's insufficient evidence to charge him with murder. Would you like want to get on an elevator with me at that point? Like, yes, I'm innocent. I'm not going to jail. But that doesn't sound great. And that occurs in the midst of all of what is described about Russia's obvious goal in getting him elected. You can support Donald Trump and be a conservative, be a crazy radical right winger, and still be kind of concerned about that. But if you watch Fox and Friends, you're not concerned about that. You're not concerned about obstruction of justice because they are very narrowly threading a needle to make it seem as if the honest declaration that Donald Trump will not be charged with anything related to a criminal conspiracy means nothing bad happened and we can just move on as a country. But far more deranged than Fox and Friends is Sean Hannity, which I don't watch and you shouldn't watch. But if you do watch, I want to give you a little bit of taste of what you will experience, not over the course of a full hour, but over the course of literally one paragraph on Media Matters. And that's why we're not showing you the video. I want to read it so that I can do a little bit of commentary. Here's what he said last night. You've had 2 years of lies and hoaxes and conspiracy theories peddled every second of every minute of every hour of every day, which of course is not true. The vast majority of what you've had is honest reporting about developments in the story. There's no hoax there. And the conspiracy theories largely had to do with Seth Rich and Uranium One, and that was Sean Hannity that was peddling those. But let's move on. And it's just one more round of lying tinfoil hat conspiracy theories. So that's what you got out of Robert Mueller's incredibly measured response was, it's just another round of tinfoil hat conspiracy theories. Let's see, Trump bashing over a narrative that is totally dead and buried. He doesn't even believe that. Let's say it is a narrative. It's obviously not dead and buried. You're doing a broadcast right now on TV about it. But that's the sort of thing that you say when you don't care if your language is actually reflective of reality. But we move on because tonight, well, the fact remains there was no Trump-Russia collusion. There was no obstruction. Nothing has changed. Okay, there might not have been a Trump-Russia conspiracy. We will grant you that. That was the conclusion of the report. But there was obstruction. There were 10 or 11 counts of it detailed, incredibly detailed, in the Mueller report, which Sean Hannity will neither read nor acknowledge. And nothing has changed. That again is true. We already knew about the obstruction from the Mueller report. That was just confirmed yesterday when Mueller spoke, but he ignored it then. He's ignoring it now. He goes on to say, Mueller has spent 20 plus months, 25 plus million investigating a hoax. But let's stop there because he knows, as we all know, that yes, the investigation does have a cost associated with it. Nobody seems to know what it is. It goes from 20 to 40 million, depending on what Trump is tweeting at a particular moment. But we also know that because of largely Paul Manafort, it has taken in more than that in value, assets that have been seized and things like that. But he goes on to say, let's jump ahead a little bit. You have a career bureaucrat, nothing more than a Trump-hating partisan who is now all but cheering for impeachment based on nothing except for the 10 or 11 counts of obstruction that are detailed that you could read if you wanted to. And we were right the entire time. But you weren't right about everything. You weren't right about most, like the obstruction of justice. You, by the way, spent 2 years asking for him to obstruct justice. It has now been detailed. You should be pleased with that. But of course, you're not even acknowledging that it happened. He also says that Robert Mueller is a partisan hack. This is where people are getting information from. And reporting today shows that a lot of Fox viewers say that they have heard nothing negative coming out of the report. Well, that's a shocker considering what media they're ingesting. Anyway, thank you for joining us on the show today. We'll be back tomorrow with Brett Ehrlich with more for you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.